I'm Dr. Omar Khan.
I'm Dr. Shannon Gowland.
I'm Dr. Tiffany Dersey. And welcome to Vet Sessions.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Vet Sessions. I'm your host, Dr. Shannon Gowland, and I'm so excited to welcome back Dr. Chantal Pinard, our OVC ophthalmology specialist. Hi, Chantal.
Good morning, Shannon.
Thanks so much for coming in today. So I thought we'd jump right into our exciting topic, which is canine glaucoma, which is something, as a general practitioner, I don't see too often, but definitely important to know and recognize it and be ready to treat it when you do. So thank you very much. So let's start right off with a definition. So what is glaucoma?
Well, glaucoma is, at the base of it, is too much pressure in the eye. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of reasons for that, and I'll get into that in a few seconds. But basically, when the eye is under pressure, it will stop to function. And that can be a permanent vision loss in certain cases. That said, if we catch it early enough, we might be able to reverse some of the damage that was done and preserve vision for an amount of time. And again, depending on the type of glaucoma, it will vary what the success rate will be. And so when we talk about glaucoma, I kind of put it into two categories. Because if you don't know the type that you have, it will severely impact how you're going to recognize it, but more importantly, treat it. So if I can spend just a few seconds on kind of the two big categories. So the first category is what I would call primary glaucoma. And primary glaucoma is when you have an eye that only has glaucoma. And you're going to go, what does that mean? And it means that the eye from birth actually was malformed. The drainage angle that serves to basically drain the eye of fluid is malfunctioning because it's malformed. Now, sometimes this can lead to a very early onset of glaucoma, which we call congenital glaucoma. But in most cases, what will happen is that the dog is more than 6 months of age, or the cat is more than 6 months of age, and probably has some genetic components to it of why the eye didn't form as normally as possible. And that, unfortunately, can take some time before we recognize it. I had a basset hound where the glaucoma only reared its head at 12 years of age, which is unusual, but it can take some time. So that's where I would call the eye is quiet, but definitely affected. There's nothing else going on except for that buildup of pressure. Then there's the secondary glaucoma, so that second family of glaucoma, which is going to be as popular as the first one. But there's another disease that causes glaucoma. So what do I mean by that? There's blood in the eye. There's a tumor in the eye, or the lens is out of place. Those are all examples of where the eye has gone into a high pressure state because there's something else that triggered it. One thing that can be sometimes challenging to diagnose is actually a retinal detachment can lead to glaucoma. And you're going to go, but wait a minute, that's in the back of the eye. Why are we having, you know, glaucoma? And it's because, in layman's term, the retina, when it detaches, and again, for a lot of different reasons, it will liberate a lot of toxins. And one of these toxins, molecules, will actually affect the iris, and the iris will go, oh, I know what to do with this toxin. I'm going to make a membrane. And this membrane goes over the angle, this drainage angle, and basically stops it from functioning. So the last piece of information I wanted to give with the definition of glaucoma is going back to, you know, how does this pressure build up? So I talked about how genetically or Mother Nature basically said the eyeball, I'm gonna make it defective right from birth, or I'm gonna have another disease and we're gonna have this high pressure. And I said to you that, you know, the pressure builds up because the eye can't drain itself properly. So now just go with it. So sure. Picture yourself in your bathroom, all right, looking at your bathroom sink.
Okay.
All right. And I'm just going to do an analogy of how the eyeball and the bathroom sink are actually quite similar.
Okay, we're with you.
Yeah, okay. So you've got the tap, right? You've got the hot and cold, but basically you've got a tap that forms basically fluid. And so that's your ciliary body. And so that's kind of the tap of your eyeball. And so this tap can't overproduce. It will produce at a constant rate. It can slow down, but it can never overproduce. And so you turn on your tap and you've got fluid that's going into your sink. And when you look at the bottom of your sink, you have the drain. That drain, if it's functioning properly, well, then the sink won't back up and you won't have, you know, a disaster in your bathroom. So the bottom line, though, is if that drain is malformed, is not functioning properly, or has too much hair, has gunk in there, well, of course, then your sink is going to start to back up.
Right.
And in dogs and cats, that's kind of the iridocorneal angle. So it's where the cornea meets the iris. And then there's these veins that are there that will help to basically evacuate, drain out the eye. And so if that's not functioning properly, that's where your glaucoma, your sink will start to overflow. But you're going to go, but wait, there's that little overflow in the middle of the sink. There's that little opening that you have. And that we call the uveal scleral outflow. In the dogs, actually, it can be quite useful. In the cats, unfortunately, not. And it can respond to medication to open up. And so, yes, to a certain degree, if your overflow is not too aggressive, then yes, that uveal scleral outflow will prevent your sink from overflowing. Or if you use medication, you can enhance it and then, again, control the pressure or control basically the level of water in your sink. So, yes, your bathroom sink and your eyeball have a lot of things in common.
I love that. Yeah, so clear. Thank you. So then what are the signs that we're going to see in a dog who has glaucoma?
The signs that we're going to see can sometimes be quite subtle. The canine glaucoma and the feline glaucoma are somewhat different from what we see in humans. And so if I can just do a segue for 2 seconds. In humans, this angle, this drainage angle, is what they call open, and they don't have headaches. And what people usually complain about is tunnel vision, is that their peripheral vision will start to diminish because the retina in the periphery is thinner. So any pressure, of course, will affect it way sooner than the central retina, which is much more robust and much thicker. So it takes more pressure to have it an effect. And 90% of human glaucoma, that's what they have. And only 10% will really have basically the headaches and the redness. And of course, you know, the acute vision loss if the pressures go too high. And unfortunately, that's what we see, is 90% of our glaucomas are these acute vision loss, redness, pain, but our patients unfortunately don't talk to us. And especially when we go back to that primary glaucoma, it'll affect one eye before the other. So a dog that has lost vision in one eye can run as fast as a dog that has two eyes.
For sure.
So, and the same goes for a cat. So the bottom line is they can be subtle. But one of the first things that will happen is because this pressure is so high, the veins in the eyeball can't flow as well, and so they get congested. So if you were to lift up the upper eyelid and look at the white of the eye, then you'll see that the veins are much more prominent. And it's kind of like, you know, your dog may have had too many beers that day, but bottom line is that you will see this redness. The other thing that you might be able to see, especially if you're comparing one eye to the other, is that the pupil will be bigger and may not react to light at all, depending again on how high the pressure is. And so you'll see that one pupil will be normal and will be reactive to light. If you put a flashlight, it'll go down. But the eye with the glaucoma will either be quite sluggish or even absent, that there will be no constriction of that pupil. And, those are kind of the very, very early subtle signs. When we go with higher pressures and the things just basically keep going on for either hours or days, then you'll see some cloudiness of the cornea. So the cornea, which is, you know, the window that we see through, the pressure inside the eye will make a certain cell not function as well. And so it'll get smoky or cloudy. Mm-hmm. And again, this would be something that would be recognized, but it can either take very high pressures, within a few hours, but more commonly, it takes a couple of days for that to happen.
Yes, and I've definitely seen a cloudy cornea like you're describing. Thank you. And sometimes it can be sort of wispy looking across the cornea, right?
Absolutely. You can sometimes see these, you know, gray to white lines, and that's just the cornea that's fracturing because the eye can only stretch so much. And so the cornea will give and we'll have those little train tracks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so then how do we go about diagnosing glaucoma?
Well, the crux of it is you need to measure the pressure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a full proponent of doing a full, you know, ocular exam, your neuro-ophthalmic findings, you know, your Schirmer tear test, your fluorescein, you really need to do tonometry. You need to do a pressure, whether that's with a Schiotz, with a Tonopen, with a Tonovet. All three instruments can give you very accurate pressures. Or inaccurate pressures if you're not using the instruments appropriately. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is you need to document the pressure in both eyes because, like I said, sometimes one eye will be affected and the other eye just not yet. And so to have that documentation is crucial. We usually, you know, say that normal pressure is between 15 to 25 millimeters of mercury. With some of the instruments, you can go as low as 10 millimeters of mercury as being considered normal. That said, I usually say what is normal for that dog is looking at the less affected eye, what is the pressure of that eye, and, you know, use that as your normal. Because if your dog or your cat is very excited, of course, the pressures are going to go up. If your dog is very sedate and nonchalant, of course, you know, their normal heart rate and blood pressure will be down. And so therefore, their intraocular pressure will also reflect that. But anything over 30 millimeters of mercury, ding, 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 we've got glaucoma.
And you mentioned three instruments, which are variably difficult to use. I think definitely, you know, becoming good at using those, like potentially practicing on your own pet or with whatever you have in the clinic is a good idea. So whether you have a Tonovet, a Tonopen, or hopefully not a Schiotz tonometer, just because they're the most difficult to use. So once we have our diagnosis, our pressure's above 30 or above 25, it sounds like, depending on what the opposite eye is. What are the first thoughts in terms of treating acute glaucoma?
Good question, and I'm going to go back to what type of glaucoma do you have? Do you have a primary glaucoma where the eye is malformed, but there's nothing else going on in there? Or do you have a secondary glaucoma where you've got another disease, you know, whether that's blood from uveitis, whether that's the lens that's out of place, or you've got a retinal detachment? All of that will impact the choice of medications. So if we go through kind of what do we have to, you know, pick off our shelf, our pharmacy mm-hmm. shelf? Unfortunately, we have no veterinary products. So we have to go with human products, which, you know, right off the bat, we're behind the eight ball because we're not really dealing with medications that are species specific. That said, it is what it is. And so the first medication that I would be reaching for that has the least amount of side effects and can definitely be used safely in the primary as well as the secondary glaucoma, so it's kind of my go-to one, mm-hmm. are the carbonic anhydrase inhibitors. And so that's a mouthful. And so yes, there's two there's two on the market. And so if I just use the trade names, Trusopt and Azopt, they're interchangeable. I prefer Azopt because it is a little less irritating than Trusopt, and especially in a cat that, you know, doesn't want to have drops to begin with. Mm-hmm. Any advantage is going to help us out. Those are going back to my, you know, bathroom sink. What that will do is diminish the tap. All right. It doesn't do anything about the drain. It doesn't do anything about that little overflow. What it does is it diminishes the tap. So at least your sink is not overflowing as fast as it did before. But by doing so, it'll take a couple of hours for that medication to work. And we start it at every 8 hours. You can go, if the pressures, you know, really respond, you can go to twice a day, so every 12 hours. But these are very much timed medications. And so doing it once a day, you're probably just wasting the product because, again, at best, it will work for 6 to 8 hours. You can go up to four times a day, which is every 6 hours. That said, doing it more often than that, I mean, you're just wasting the product. And so that's the first one I would reach for. That said, I know that it's going to take a couple of hours to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in an emergency situation where you really want to give something that's going to diminish the pressures, and this actually starts working within the first 10 minutes, is actually mannitol.
Mm-hmm.
And so mannitol, which is an osmotic diuretic, what that will do is basically suck out the juice from the eyeball, basically, in layman's terms. And yes, it can work very, very quickly. The issue I have with mannitol is not a drop. You have to put in a 2-inch catheter because you don't want it to go outside of the vein.
Yes.
And so you do need to put in a catheter, make sure it's properly placed. It's 1 to 2 grams per kilogram. And no, I did not make a mistake. It's gram per kilogram. I usually start with the 1 and keep the other gram in my back pocket if I need it an hour later. And you don't want to give it too fast. You can't give it as a bolus. You got to give it over 20 minutes. Otherwise, you're going to vomit. And, you know, who wants to clean that up? Certainly not an ophthalmologist.
Very true.
So the bottom line is, you know, sit with the dog, give it over 20 minutes. But even after 20 minutes, if you start measuring the pressures, you will see that they will start to decrease. And so that's, you know, another one that you can reach in very much emergency situations. Make sure that your mannitol is well dissolved because it does have crystals. And so make sure that, you know, you either have a filter or you make sure that it's a little bit warmed up so all those crystals are gone. There are two other kind of categories of medication that you can give, but these two categories can be contraindicated in certain patients. So that's why I'm not jumping right off the bat. One of them is beta blockers, and the main one that we have is timolol at a 0.5% concentration. This is what human ophthalmologists use bucket loads for, because mm-hmm. in human ophthalmology, it is very effective. In our case, not as much. It is way more effective if you combine it with the TruSopt and Azopt. There is a synergy and additive effect with it, which is good. But it can be contraindicated in certain situations. It will cause just a little bit of meiosis. So if that lens is in the front part of the eye, that may not be one that you want to choose and trap the lens there. Or in cats, if they have asthma, beta blocker may not be your first choice.
For sure.
And so, again, knowing the status of your patient would be something to consider. Or if they have any heart disease, I have, and I will fully admit that I've made some of my canine patients with heart disease a little bit worse with beta blockers. So you think, oh, but it's just a drop, and it went onto the eyeball.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm, yeah, but it does get absorbed by the body and basically will cause, you know, a little bit of a slowing down of the heart rate. And so it does. It can affect the whole body. The eyeballs are you know, the tip of the iceberg for the rest of the body. So you got to be careful.
So not only are they the most important system, but also the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And ophthalmologists do not like to deal with heart disease or asthma or vomiting.
So exactly.
It's a good way to remember it.
Exactly. And then the last category of medications, which are kind of the newest ones on the market, are what we call prostaglandin analogs. And so you've got latanoprost, bimatoprost. There's quite a few on the market now. Travoprost or Xalatan are the two more common trade names that you would have. And so what they do is actually cause a little bit of uveitis. They cause inflammation because it's a prostaglandin analog.
Interesting.
And you're going to go, well, okay, how does that work? Well, by causing inflammation, going back to your bathroom sink, it will slow down the ciliary body. So it will, you know, not shut down the tap, but definitely reduce its production. But remember, we talked about that little overflow. In dogs, not in cats, in dogs, that will kind of upregulate that little overflow. And so by doing so, it will help to reduce the pressure. And it can be actually quite effective of, you know, working in 1 hour. And so, you know, the question begs, well, why didn't she just mention that one right off the bat? It's a drop, first of all. It works within the hour. You don't have to put in a catheter. Well, unfortunately, nothing is perfect. And by causing inflammation, if you already have that in your eye, if you've already got blood or fibrin, it's just going to make it worse. Mm-hmm. It also will contract the pupil. And so if you've got an anterior lens luxation, not the best to use. And so it's not my first go-to in the secondary glaucomas, but in the primary glaucomas where the eye is quiet, there's no other disease going on, then absolutely it can be quite effective. And this type of drug actually sometimes you can go down to once a day, which owners love, not having to put in too many drops. And so again, depending on the type of glaucoma you have, so if I just do a quick review, the primary glaucoma, I call it the triple cocktail. You would go with your TruSopt or Azopt, your beta blocker, which again, as long as you don't have any other secondary conditions, and your prostaglandin analogs, you know, you give all three drops 5 minutes apart, measure the pressure, you know, an hour later, and you should have a significant drop. If you've got the secondary glaucoma, this is where you're going to have to juggle medications, where you're going to have to determine if you've got a tumor in there. Well, unfortunately, your options are limited. If you've got a retinal detachment, again, your options may be limited. If you've got inflammation, then some medications, like I said, the prostaglandin analogs may not be your best choice. Or if your lens is out of place, again, you got to be careful about that. So you're going to go, well, the secondary glaucomas, you're kind of up a creek. And I'm like, well, you are, your options are a little bit more limited. But if you've got inflammation, actually, it's not an anti-glaucoma medication, but prednisolone acetate or dexamethasone, just a very powerful anti-inflammatory, a steroid, can actually help decrease the pressure. Because if you've got blood, if you've got fibrin, it's kind of like hair in your drain. Well, if you remove the hair, well, your drain's going to work better. And so if you remove the inflammation, the angle kind of goes, whew, I can work now. And so anti-glaucoma medications can actually include anti-inflammatories. And I would go with the steroids. Topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, unfortunately, can sometimes increase pressure. So, you know, just go with the big guns.
Sounds good.
And then, you know, and measure the pressure.
Sounds great. Wow, that's such a great review of all of those anti-glaucoma medications. Thank you so much. I really love the sync analogy. It just makes it everything so much clearer for us. So thank you. So for a patient with glaucoma then, when should we be considering referral to an ophthalmologist?
Well, I would have a tendency to say the sooner the better, just so you know your options, mm-hmm. because there are surgical options that a general practitioner may not be able to do or have access to. And so the surgical options, again, are best described and explained by an ophthalmologist because we're the ones who do it. And one of them is to actually put in a secondary drain, put in a tube in the eye. That's, you know, to shunt some of the fluid away. There are other, you know, surgical options where we're actually lasering basically the ciliary body. So basically trying to shut off that tap or decrease it to be to its minimum. But those require specialized instruments, basically a lot of experience of how to do that. And again, depending on the type of glaucoma, there might also be other options. And so the sooner you can get in, the better. Or even having a chat on the phone or an email would be to discuss the case, might be able to give that information to your client, and then they can make the decision whether or not they want to be referred. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, the damage is too far gone, and so removal of the eye is required for pain management and patient welfare, because they will have a migraine, and, you know, enucleations can be done by the general practitioner, and so, you know, referral may not be needed because enucleation is the best option for that patient.
Sure. So once they're non-visual for a period of time, what would be that period of time? I guess, like, is it once they're non-visual, enucleation is considered, or?
That's a great question. And it's, and again, it's a case dependent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen dogs be permanently blind after 2 hours of high pressures, versus I've seen cats, for example, where we've been able to decrease the pressure and vision has returned. And so I usually try to give them the benefit of the doubt. And you need to have normal pressures, mm-hmm. first of all, because if you still have high pressures, then of course vision is going to be affected. But if you can have normal pressures, so again, between that 15 to 25 as a general rule of thumb, and the vision hasn't come back, I usually give it a good 7 to 10 days. That said, if you can't get the pressures down after 48 hours, or 72 hours actually, and the vision, of course, odds are, will be gone, then again, for patient welfare, and you've used all the drops, and whether you've been referred yes or no, again, depending on the case, you know, removal of the eye, as sad as that is, may be the best option for the patient.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. After all, a painful non-visual eye is not helping anyone. So,
okay. Exactly.
Okay, thank you. And you made a great point that, you know, sometimes referral isn't possible for a client, whether they're, you know, in a remote area or whether it is just not possible due to cost. But developing a relationship with your referring ophthalmologist and then being able to message them and, you know, ask questions about your case, that is so valuable.
It is, because, you know, we might come up with a strategy, and then we know that we've dotted all our I's and crossed all our T's, and then that will make the decision much easier, not only for the client, but also for the referring vet,
yeah.
that, you know, options are limited and, you know, some tough decisions have to be made. There is, in my opinion, a grieving process when we remove an eye, but it can be facilitated by saying, I've either researched or I've asked and our options are limited. And so therefore we don't have much of a choice.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You know, there's a huge emotional component for clients. Well, and for the veterinarian actually, mm-hmm. you know, when we do decide to perform an enucleation, but at the same time, you know, when you see that pet wake up so much more comfortable, you know, it does feel better having made that decision if it's the right one.
And, you know, and coming back to, you know, the pain aspect, a lot of times we don't recognize ocular pain. Mm-hmm. It's kind of similar to dental pain, but for those of us who suffer, you know, from headaches and migraines, I mean, you don't see it from the outside, but then you'll see these changes in personality or behaviors. They may not want to go for a walk as long as they used to, or eat as voraciously as they used to. But then when the eye is treated, either with medication or removal, as the case may be, you know, 2 weeks later when they come for that suture removal, mm-hmm. I've had a cat patient where when they developed glaucoma, they weren't sleeping under the covers anymore. They were sleeping on the bed. But once we removed the eye and, you know, they came back for a suture removal 2 weeks later, the client was amazed that now the cat was now sleeping under the covers again.
Wow.
And so these changes in behaviors and personality can be very subtle. And so because glaucoma can cycle in and out. And so it's going to be tough for owners sometimes to pick it up until, unfortunately, you know, the damage is done irreversibly. But then it's looking at the other eye and making sure that we have a plan of action for the other eye, depending again on what the cause was. And so hopefully we can prolong, you know, the retention of the other eye with vision.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, let's talk more about that. So assuming that we've gotten pressures under control, how do we treat glaucoma in the longer term?
Oh, I wish I had a crystal ball to be able to answer that question. Because again, it's case dependent. But if we go back to our two categories for primary glaucoma, there's nothing written in our books to say, well, you do it once a week, every couple of months. It's, you know, it will depend on availability, cost, and so forth. But I would have a tendency to say is as long as you have the pressures decreased for 24 hours, then, you know, you can go and check the pressure basically 5 days later, definitely before the weekend, mm-hmm. To make sure that they haven't rebounded back up. That said, if the pressures are good, then you probably can go once a month. But just know that medications, I mean, you're decreasing the tap, you might be increasing a little bit that overflow, but you're not fixing the drain. Mm-hmm. So medication will fail. Whether that's in 3 months, 6 months, you know, you will have to increase the frequency of your medications as the pressures go back up. And so the bottom line is I've had some dogs on medication 4 years out, which are a little bit of the outliers, but I've also had some where within the first month or so, they just rebounded back up. Independently of what drop we were putting in, and we've had to make, you know, those difficult decisions. With the second family of glaucomas, again, it depends. I mean, if you've got inflammation and you can get it under control within the first, you know, 24 to 48 hours, then yeah, I would have, again, a tendency to say remeasure the pressures in 5 days or definitely before the weekend. And then, you know, maybe you can let a good 10 days go by. And as the inflammation is resolving, then you can, you know, space that out. And so it really, you know, and if the lens is out of place, well, then referral to an ophthalmologist for them to extract the lens might be something to consider. And then at that point, again, depending on what is going on, you might be able to, you know, stretch out those rechecks. But I always tell the owners, though, to have those drops on hand. And if they even suspect that the pressures are going up because of the redness of the eye, the cloudiness of the cornea, go ahead and put in the drops and then, you know, go to your local emergency clinic, your family vet, just to get that pressure checked. But because glaucoma is so unforgiving, I'd rather, you know, give the medication, play it safe, then get the pressures checked to make sure that, you know, the eye responded appropriately.
Okay, that makes so much sense. Thank you, I like that. Okay, so are there any other sort of special, more complex situations we should be aware of?
I would just, you know, kind of going back to that second family of glaucomas, if your dog has a cancer, which is unfortunate, if your dog has an autoimmune type of disease, if your dog has an infectious disease, if they have basically any disease, it can affect the eyes. Okay. I've seen lymphoma, for example. We were talking about cancer. I've seen lymphoma basically also show up in the eyes. Now, thankfully, the chemotherapy that the oncologists will prescribe will positively affect the eyes as long as not too much damage has occurred. Okay. If you have infectious disease like blastomycosis, if you've got a fungal disease, a lot of times that will also show up in the eye, whether you have the organism itself or just the byproducts. And so anti-inflammatory therapy is going to be crucial. And yes, I do recommend very low dose of oral prednisone to with these blastomycosis because of the retinal detachment. Drops are just not going to get back there. So oral medications might be needed. And so depending on, you know, again, what you have, and if you have a fox terrier, rat terrier, soft coat Wheaton terrier, Jack Russell terrier, blank terrier,
yes,
then lens luxations, unfortunately, so the lens basically coming out of its normal place, and they're therefore impeding the flow of the fluid inside the eye, can definitely be something to watch out for. And so, and again, one eye will be affected before the other. And so, not that terriers are complex,
they're fairly straightforward breed, yeah, but.
And so those that I would be on the lookout for. And then coming back to our little kitty cats, the good news, if I can phrase it that way in quotation marks, is they don't really have a lot of the primary glaucomas that we see in the dogs where genetics has played a factor. Unfortunately, what they do is they fall into the second category of, and especially with inflammation, you know, these cats come in with, and you test them up the yin yang, and you just don't find a cause for the uveitis. But the uveitis, if it's long enough and severe enough, will trigger a glaucoma in these cats. And these guys are so good at hiding pain. Mm-hmm. And so the bottom line is it can be very, very difficult for the owner to know that something's going on until the eye starts to stretch. And, you know, because of the pressure, the eye will actually get bigger, whether it's a cat or a dog. And so by the time that the eye starts to stretch, unfortunately, a lot of damage has occurred. Yeah. And so your options are very much limited at that point in time.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, thank you so much. That is such a thorough covering of a really complex topic. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. And so just before we leave, I know that you are so well known for having amazing life chats with our students. And we're now at the time of year when the Topaz Turtles, go Turtles, are just about to graduate and start their real lives as veterinarians. So do you have any of your amazing wisdom or advice you'd like to give them?
Oh, well, thank you for that. I do love chatting with the students. And when we do these life chats, I let the students ask me any question under the sun. And but one advice that I do come up with at every session is just to let them know that their first job is their first job. They will have a second job. Yes, there are few individuals that get into a clinic and stay there forever and ever, but that's not common, and that's not the reality for most of us, and even for me, it was not my reality. And just to know that you will have a second job, because your first is your first. And so you will have a second. You might have a third and a fourth, and that's okay. To be able to find, you know, a place where you jive with can take a few.
Yeah, it's very true. A job is a relationship with the people at the clinic, with the community. I mean, it's like any other relationship. Sometimes it takes more than once to get the right one.
Exactly.
Speaking for myself and probably for most people. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I love that piece of advice. Sometimes people think, you know, they leap into practice and think, that's it, this is my job forever, and I need to keep that one. And if I don't, then there's probably something wrong with me.
And there isn't.
No.
There isn't. No. Totally agree. Your first job is your first job because you will have a second.
I love that. I love that. Okay, so hopefully the turtles can take that piece of advice off with them. And who knows, maybe the first job will be their life job. But for most of us, it's not, and that's totally okay. That was wonderful. Thank you so much for being here with us today and teaching all of us so much about glaucoma. So I'd like to just say a quick thank you to our podcast sponsors, OVC Pet Trust. Pet Trust is a charitable fund dedicated to improving and advancing companion animal health and welfare. We greatly appreciate their support. Learn more at www.pettrust.ca. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please follow us on Instagram at Vet Sessions or email us at vetsessions@hotmail.com. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for future podcasts. Take care, everyone. Till next time.